Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary number of Fox News analysts who will be staffing the Trump White House, in part because Trump watches Fox News and gets much of his information from it. Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society, joins us to discuss how Fox News, the Pravda of the Republican Party, will now become the voice, if not the brains, of the White House. We will also discuss the irony, now that Trump is considering General Petraeus to be the next Secretary of State, of the appointment of Fox News analyst K.T. McFarland as the Deputy National Security Advisor, given her past effort on behalf of Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to recruit General Petraeus to run for president against his Commander-in-Chief Barack Obama in 2012. Apparently, Petraeus's conviction for sharing classified information with his mistress does not rise to the level of Crooked Hillary's alleged crime of having a private email server for which she was exonerated by the FBI. Then we'll examine the latest possible terrorist incident, which the Islamic State is taking credit for, that took place on the campus of The Ohio State University, where a Somali student drove his car into a crowd on the pavement, then slashed at them with a butcher's knife, wounding 11, one critically. The author of Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, John Mueller, a professor of political science and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at The Ohio State University, joins us to discuss the apparent last-minute conversion of this hapless defender of Muslims, including the Rohingya in Myanmar, who was shot dead by a campus policeman. Then finally, we'll get an update on the recounts of the votes in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan from Daniel Tokaji, a professor of law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and the co-author of the casebook Election Law, Cases and Materials. We will discuss the likelihood that the results in these states will not be overturned, but that this will end up as an audit or an investigation to rule out hacking, intentional disregarding of ballots, or illegal coordination between election officials and campaigns, etc. And joining us now is Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as the director of the experimental research of the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Cassino.
Hey, it's great to be back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dan. And this does seem extraordinary, the number of people that have that are going to the White House and are sort of traipsing via Donald Trump's golf course down there in New Jersey, along with Trump Tower, is pretty amazing. It would seem that, as I was saying, that in many ways, this looks like it's not just going to be the voice of the White House, Fox News, but in effect, the brains.
Well, it's actually not that surprising that Trump is recruiting so heavily from Fox News. In the old days, after you left office, after a Republican administration, you would go to work in a think tank or go to work in a lobbying shop. And while that was lucrative and generally more lucrative than government service, it wasn't very high profile. This is almost more retirement. It's like a TV show that goes in syndication. That's where the real money is, but nobody's paying attention to anymore. After the Bush administration, we really saw that Fox News became the place where you could retire to after leaving government service. It was lucrative. You could not only be on Fox News, maybe host your own show, but you could parlay that into a radio show and some pretty big book sales. But it also kept up a national appearances. You're able to be in the news. And having that appearance meant you were more able to go back into the news and back into public life later on. We've seen this already going on with people like Newt Gingrich and Mike Huckabee. After you leave, Fox News is a good place to go so you can keep up your visibility and eventually move back in. And we're seeing a lot of that. So it's not surprising that someone like K.T. McFarland or other people that have moved into Fox News would be willing to move out back into Republican administration. If anything, this is a sign of exactly how much of an establishment Republican administration Trump is putting together. I'd also take a little issue with your idea that Fox News is going to be really the brains of it, because Trump has some problems with Fox News. There's certainly some big policy disagreements there, where Fox News is much more on the side, traditionally, of Chamber of Commerce Republicans, who really don't like all this talk that Trump is making about trade and bringing jobs back. And so there's going to be some tension there between him and Fox News. I'd be worried that Breitbart would be the voice of Fox News, than, the voice of Trump, the Trump administration than Fox News is.
Well, in terms of Fox News analysts, just recently in the last few days, Fran Townsend has gone through the doors of Trump Tower, along with the Fox News contributor Pete Hegseth. And then you've got Scott Brown, the former Massachusetts senator. He, of course, we mentioned Katie McFarland. We'll get to that later. Laura Ingraham and Monica Crowley are both being considered for the role of White House Press Secretary. John Bolton, of course, a Fox News contributor, is also on the short list for Secretary of State. And he also, Donald Trump just huddled yesterday with Jeanine Pirro of Fox News' Justice with Judge Jeanine. I don't know what position she might be considered. And you mentioned, of course, Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich. So there's quite a few of them, shall we say.
There certainly is. I think the least surprising of these, for me, are Laura Ingraham and Monica Crowley. We saw even during the Bush administration, there was a push to actually bring on hosts from Fox News in order to run the press shop, because during the Bush administration, Fox News is doing a better job of explaining the Bush administration than the Bush administration was. So if you want people that have some media credibility and can come in and talk up Republican administration and explain that, well, Fox News is going to be your best place to go for that. We should also note that one thing that's really going on here is the real is a real basis of personal loyalty, this concern with personal loyalty that Roger Ailes had, that we're seeing moving forward into a Trump administration. So the people that are going into Trump's office, you know, to audition or to kiss the ring, they're going. Those people are not the people who have kind of in later months been rebelling against Roger Ailes. These are the people that were the Roger Ailes loyalists going in, and so it's likely that they've got Roger Ailes' seal of approval to move out of Fox News now that he's not running it anymore.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and the author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. So it does seem extraordinarily coincidental. I refer to it as an irony that just a couple of days ago now, General Petraeus met with Donald Trump, and he's on the short list to be Secretary of State. There's a kind of standoff between the New York former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani and the former candidate for president Mitt Romney, who is apparently a lot of the Trump supporters aren't happy about. So it's not inconceivable that it will go to a third person like Petraeus. But in the spring of 2011, Roger Ailes sent K.T. McFarland, who's now Deputy National Security Advisor, to Afghanistan to then talk with the commander of U.S. and coalition forces there, General Petraeus, in his office in Kabul. They had a 90-minute conversation, which was recorded, I'm not sure by whom, at which she offered, as an emissary from Roger Ailes, she offered the presidency, in effect, to General Petraeus in 2012 to run against his commander-in-chief at the time, Barack Obama, and Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox News or News Corp, would bankroll the campaign, and Roger Ailes would resign and run the campaign. Let's listen to just a couple of minutes of this extraordinary exchange of the kingmakers and General Petraeus.
Directly advice to you from Roger Ailes is...
Do you want us to leave, sir?
I'm not running.
And that's not the question at this point. He says that if you're offered chairman, take it. If you're offered anything else, don't take it. Resign in 6 months and run for president. Okay? And I know you're not running for president, but at some point when you go to New York next, you may want to just... chat with Roger and
Rupert's after me as well. Look, what I have told people is that, you know, I truly want to continue to serve my country if it is in a you know, a quite significantly meaningful position. And there's all of about two of those in the world. You all have really got to shut your mouths, or shut your, yeah, and shut your mouths too.
Yeah, and I'm only reporting this back to Roger, and that's
ideal. And, you know, obviously the chairman would be one of them, and there might be one other, but that's about it. And I'm not going to, you know, don't want to go to NATO meetings for the rest of my life or, you know, fight service budget battles or anything like that. So,
can I give you the gossip that I picked up about all that?
What's that?
I mean, I'm sure you've heard better gossip, but I've talked to some former chiefs about this very topic. And they said, well, you know, the White House is particularly nervous.
Of course
about,
they are.
Well, but they're here, and here's the thinking, that they're nervous about... They feel that Obama had this mandate, okay, the mandate or the, in his own mind. Obama wanted to do Obamacare, which is a sixth of the economy. He wanted to do environment, which is basically controlling all aspects of the economy, and education, which is the future. So he pushed for Obamacare, got that done. They didn't anticipate 2010 results, but he now is going to lie low and be very centrist so that they win in 12 and then they get the other two. Now, what they need, and this is not from the chiefs, this is from political people, and what they need to cement it so that it doesn't get reversed is a third term. And that means 2016 they need to win, the Democrats need to win, and they need to win with their guy, their kind of guy. So that then you have the stuff that's locked in place for a generation. Nobody can come in like Reagan came in and reversed.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's their plan. You're their problem. And so,
they can never believe.
I know they're probably related to Ossi Sidarni, but what their plan is, but they think that if you're chairman, they can't overrule you. They can't go against whatever your advice is going to be militarily. Plus, they have a Colin Powell problem, where Colin Powell, very successful chairman, is everybody's sort of rallying point to run. Next time you go to New York, you're going to start
I'd be happy. I would love to see him. Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen him in a while, so.
I think he would very much appreciate
I'd love to see
conversation.
Him. Yep.
And
he's a brilliant guy.
He is simply brilliant.
Tell him if I ever ran, but I won't.
Okay, I know.
But if I ever ran, I'd take him up on his offer.
Okay. All right.
He said he would quit Fox.
I know. He said he only
And bankroll it.
Bankroll it?
Or maybe I'm confusing that with Rupert. No.
Yeah, I think Rogers, you know, it's not okay, but... Well, I think the one who's bankrolling it is the big boss.
That might be it.
The big boss is bankrolling it. Roger's going to run it, and the rest of us are going to be your in-house.
Yeah, right. Okay.
We're all set. We got the poster on.
It's never going to happen. No,
it's never going to happen.
My wife would divorce me.
Right.
And I love my wife.
Tell her it's a beautiful house.
We have a beautiful house.
And that is a tape from the origins of which I'm not sure, that was obtained by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, of a meeting in the spring of 2011 between Katie McFarland, who's now the Deputy National Security Advisor, of a Fox News analyst, and General Petraeus, who is on the shortlist to become the next Secretary of State. So, Dan, That's king making. There's a lot of hubris in that, wouldn't you say?
Certainly. Well, of course, the funniest thing in there is Petraeus saying, boy, he couldn't run for president because his wife had divorced him. He loves his wife so much.
Right.
given what we later found out about what was going on at the time. It is, but it also shows the real role Fox News had at that point under Roger Ailes. People think Roger Ailes now as this media mogul, but before that, he was a guy in Republican politics, a Republican kingmaker, going back to Richard Nixon. And he'd been the guy who had been worked on the Nixon campaigns, worked on the Reagan campaign. He's thought to be responsible for Reagan's quips during the 1980 and 1984 presidential debates. So he had been a Republican kingmaker. So it's not at all surprising that he would try and get back in the game, that he would be looking for candidates after he theoretically retired from electoral politics in 1984. So the fact that Roger Ailes had connections with all of the players here meant that he was able to take people like K.T. McFarland and put them in the right place to make his offers. Now, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of hubris to that, and I would actually be a little bit surprised if Rupert Murdoch had actually agreed to bankroll something, given that Rupert Murdoch generally stays out of direct connection with electoral politics. He's much more concerned with making money than making policy. But it's interesting that Roger Ailes is still keeping up that role. So I think Roger Ailes, this is a guy who came into politics during the Mike Douglas show, for goodness sake. And the fact that, you know, it's 2016, and this guy is still playing a role, a major role in Republican administrations, and that his, even if he's not, doesn't have a major role, his loyalists that came with him through the Fox News are still having a role. That's amazing. I mean, to some extent, the story of Roger Ailes is the story of the Republican Party in the 20th century.
Well, this is a 90-minute tape. The meeting took place over 90 minutes back in Kabul in 2011. And what I found extraordinary about the full tape is that Petraeus is actually very thoughtful about what he wants to do. And he's trying to explain to K.T. McFarland why he wants to take over the CIA and how he sees the future of warfare and intelligence and the role of the CIA. And she keeps keeps talking like a political hack, doesn't get what he's saying. It literally doesn't get what he's saying. And it's shocking to think that she's the Deputy National Security Advisor. I mean,
well, we have to understand that the Fox News and Ailes are much more concerned with packaging than they are with policy. It's always about how do we package this to make it more appealing. And there's much less concern with the actual intricacies of policy. The thought is, well, the policy will work itself out. Our job is to score political points. Ailes famously talked about the stage theory of politics, where the idea is if two people get on a stage, one of them trips and falls in the orchestra pit, and the other gives a great speech, who's the audience going to talk about tomorrow? Right? Your job is to be the guy who falls into the orchestra pit, because that's going to suck all the air out of the room. And if you can get Petraeus in there, you get him to run for president, he has all these ideas about policy, whatever. Well, that doesn't matter. What really matters is he is a great vessel. He is great for packaging. He is great for appearances. And that's what Roger Ailes' genius really is. You know, if you're talking Richard Nixon, you don't talk about his policy. You don't talk his personality. You find phrases that will get the public behind him. And that's what Ailes is good at, and that's what he's still good at. We should note, that's actually fairly dangerous in politics, because people wind up supporting stuff without having any idea what they're really supporting, because what they're really supporting is the idea that's put forward, the vision that's put forward, rather than the actual concrete policy proposals.
Well, talking about falling into the orchestra pit, Donald Trump pushed the envelope in that regard and became president. And he didn't change. He was faithful to Donald Trump with all of his shortcomings. That's an amazing situation we're in. I thank you for joining us, Dan Cascino. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure speaking with you again, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Cascino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He also serves as the director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. And his latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the latest possible terrorist incident at The Ohio State University, which the Islamic State is taking credit for. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, the Woodies Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies, and a professor of both political science and dance at The Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, War and Ideas, Selected Essays, and his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. And he has an article at Reason Magazine, ISIS Isn't an Existential Threat to America, Why Politicians Shouldn't Overestimate the Terror Group's Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Great. Thanks. Great to be here.
And, of course, ISIS, the Islamic State, Daesh, as it's, the local people prefer to call it, pretty much on the ropes. They're basically being wiped out slowly in Mosul and also in Raqqa, their capital. So by the time Donald Trump becomes president, it's not inconceivable that Obama will have pretty much delivered on his promise to degrade and destroy the group. But nevertheless, the Islamic State is taking credit for what happened on your university campus yesterday, John Mueller. I'm quoting from Amaq, the Islamic State's news agency, saying, "Brother Abdel Razik Ali Atan, God accept him, implementer of the Ohio attack, a student in his third year in university, etc." And they should have a picture of him. So I guess it doesn't cost them anything to take credit, right?
Yeah, and they generally take credit only for people who have been killed, so that they can't come up and say later, I don't give a damn about the Islamic State. So they're reasonably cagey about that.
At this point, though, what do we know about this Somali student's background, and particularly his Facebook postings, which seem to indicate that he was some kind of last-minute convert?
Yeah, well, he's was, like many people involved in terrorism, motivated, it looks like, if these postings are correct, sort of an outrage and being sick and tired, as he put it, about the way Muslims are being killed in the Middle East by the Americans. Overwhelmingly, terrorism within the United States has been not caused by hostility toward democracy or toward the United States or toward American freedoms, but rather outrage has been generated by hostility to American foreign policy in the Middle East and the killing of Muslims. He apparently said he wants them to stop interfering with other countries, especially in the Muslim areas.
So what was the what's the mood there on campus? I mean, the country goes crazy every time any of these things happen, and some of them have been horrific, like the Orlando nightclub shooting, etc. And some of them have been sort of minor and somewhat incompetent. In this case, he sort of tried to run down people with his car, and then he attacked people with a butcher's knife. He wounded 11. One of the people apparently is in critical condition. So, given how the press and the nation tends to overreact, what's the mood there on the campus of The Ohio State University?
Well, generally, it looks like everything's pretty much back to normal. In fact, it was by yesterday afternoon. There's a seminar I was going to, and it got rescheduled for a half hour later by a visiting faculty member. And today, all the classes are back going on. I just went past the place where the event took place, and it looks as normal as ever. So I think and I doubt if there's going to be a huge outrage or concern or anything. It's just a tragic and pointless issue, event.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies, and a professor of both political science and dance at The Ohio State University. His books include Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, and his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. Well, but then again, the question remains, is this a pattern here? Is there a detectable pattern about these self-radicalized immigrants here in the United States? I mean, what is strange is that this student is from Somalia, who spent, I think, 6 or 7 years in Pakistan before coming to the United States, had apparently been interviewed by the local student newspaper, had he not? And
yes, last summer, right. And he was just, you know, talking about, you know, life on campus and sort of getting adjusted and so forth. And other people have been, students have been interviewed. And from what I've seen, they mostly see him as sort of a fairly normal guy. That's not terribly unusual. Sometimes people who turn out to be terrorists are pretty evidently so in a lot of ways, and people are not surprised. But frequently, it's, as in this case, it's the reverse. They're sort of surprised that this fairly mild-mannered kid would do something like this. The event is fairly typical in the sense of what you mentioned before, namely incompetence. These are, you know, very sort of riled up amateurs who don't seem to know quite what they're doing, and they end up either with long jail sentences or dead, as in this case. There's been a certain amount of flurry recently, sort of the inspiration by coming from ISIS, encouraging people to do things like this. And the results over and over again have been remarkably limited. You know, an effort to try to stab a policeman in Philadelphia and in Boston and New York and so forth, or in this case, trying to stab a bunch of students. They're notable basically for their sort of limited impact in terms of what they're trying to do. And the Orlando thing stands out very much as an extreme outlier that so many people were killed by that guy. But he was also a trained security guard. He knew how to handle firearms. And most of the others are much more like this guy, who probably never picked up a gun, and of course didn't even use one in the case. And there's been two other attacks, which are rather similar in respects, on college campuses over the last few years. One was near you, at the University of California, Merced. A guy basically decided he would carry out jihad. He was also extremely angry because he'd been kicked out of a study group for a class. And he had this elaborate plan, which was to take a knife and go to the class, which had 15 students in it, and then with the knife force them to be tied up to furniture, and then to spread the floor with petroleum jelly, then call the police with a bogus call of distress. When the police came in, they'd be slipping and sliding on the petroleum jelly. He would then attack them with his knife and steal their guns, and then shoot the students who had kicked him out of the study group. That was his brilliant plan, and he ended up very dead, just like this guy, very quickly. So, I mean, just a preposterous comic opera or comic tragedy opera sort of element in that. The other was at University of California, the University of North Carolina. And in that case, a guy tried to use a vehicle to kill people. And unlike the Ohio State guy, he actually went out and bought a somewhat larger vehicle than he already had, and he plowed through the University of North Carolina campus, injuring a few people, and then driving off. Then he later called up the police and said he was the one that did it, and he left a manifesto and so forth explaining, you know, why he was doing it. But there are just the case after case like that, which are ludicrously tragic, you know, both ludicrous and tragic, but basically don't cause that much damage. And the thing to keep in mind, it seems to me, overall, is that since 9/11, the number of Americans killed by Islamist extremists has been about 6 per year. That's 6 too many, obviously. We'd like the number to be 0, but it's a very small number. And it doesn't look like it's going to change very much. In fact, it'll probably be going down because someone bumped up because of the temporarily because of the Orlando killings. So the issue is, if the result of all this is that 6 people die every year, is that a hazard big enough to spend a huge amount of effort dealing with? Now, the number of people who are killed by deer is like something like 150. The number of people who die each year from falls in bathtubs is drowning in bathtubs is about 300. The number of people who die on the highway, of course, is in the tens of thousands. So the question is, where do you want to put your resources? These are obviously not cosmic issues or cosmic action. And it also seems that Mark Stewart and I deal with this in Chasing Ghosts, that it's not clear at all that this is caused by the security measures. The argument would be, of course, okay, it's six, very low. It's very low at six, and that's because the security measures are so great. But the problem is that you can look at all the cases like this guy, for example, and I've done a case book of these called Terrorism Since 9/11, the American Cases. It's posted online. It's a web book. In fact, I'm just in the process of adding 10 more cases in the next couple of weeks. And if you look, and everybody who looks at these cases carefully, like, for example, the one I described in North Carolina, or this one, or the one at University of California, Merced, sort of looks at this as, suppose these guys had not been caught. How much damage could they have done? And when you look at it, you say, well, you know, they did have big bombs in some cases, but when they had a big bomb, it was supplied for them by the FBI. And the question was, if they hadn't been caught, these are the ones who were caught and had not carried out an attack, could they have done very much? What would they have likely done? And when you look at them and say, well, you know, these guys are sort of dangerous. They certainly were interested in doing bad things like this guy at Ohio State, but their capacities were incredibly low. So even if these guys had not been caught, you might have higher than six per year who have been killed. It might be 12 or 20, which would be 12 or 20 too many, obviously, as well. But it's still an incredibly small number. The other argument is that the security measures have deterred people from attacking. And that just seems to be a preposterous conclusion. It almost certainly is the case that certain security measures have been successful at deterring certain people from attacking certain targets, like airliners. If you're a terrorist, I would strongly advise not trying to take down an airliner. It's very difficult. But as was demonstrated very tragically almost exactly a year ago in Paris, there remain in society an infinite number of targets, peaceful assemblies of people at restaurants or sporting stadiums or concerts, or just simply walking down the street. And if your goal is to kill people to make a political point, the number of targets is endless. So if you may be deterred from attacking an airplane, but if you're a dedicated terrorist, you certainly have plenty of other targets to choose among. So when you look at that, and that's what we do in Chasing Ghosts, it really seems that it's hard to imagine. The security measures have certainly not done some good, in the sense that there probably were some people who were caught who would probably kill some people, but the numbers they're likely to kill is extremely small. And the question keeps coming up is, do we really want to spend so much money dealing with a hazard which is of such limited consequence?
So back to the incident yesterday on your campus at the Ohio State University, John Mueller, the sort of rambling Facebook posting, which I'm not sure about whether it was taken down or where it is and what the sourcing on it is, but it's been quoted pretty extensively. And it's pretty amazing to see that this U.S.-born cleric, Awlaki, the Yemeni who was killed by a drone in Yemen, again, this fellow Abdel Razak Ali Atan, the Somali who arrived here in 2014 with his family after having spent 7 years in Pakistan, he claims inspiration from Awlaki, and also, but he goes on about the Rohingya, which the government of Burma are persecuting and essentially ethnically cleansing. And of course, you know, you don't normally associate Buddhists with that kind of behavior, but nevertheless, it's happening in Burma, Myanmar. So, again, this is a last minute conversion and a sort of grab bag of grievances. I don't know what can be done in terms of keeping an eye on people who may make this transgression. I guess in this current environment with Donald Trump having made such an issue out of how we've done everything wrong, we've got to bring back waterboarding, we've been too soft on them, Obama doesn't have a clue, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, your point surely is that we've already spent zillions on this stuff and have very little to show for it. So do you expect Donald Trump to throw some more money down the
same
road?
Well, he might. God knows what he's going to do, because, you know, paragraph three contradicts what he said in paragraph one and so forth. And he's also backed away somewhat on the torture issue, because he's talked to a general and said torture doesn't really do much good. And so he's rethinking that one, I guess, but who knows whether that'll last or not. But in general, the United States has spent $1 trillion, more than $1 trillion, on homeland security that's within the United States. That doesn't include the wars abroad or anything like that, or even intelligence abroad. And that's an awful lot of money to deal with a hazard which kills a handful of people each year. And both in Chasing Ghosts and in the earlier work, Terror, Security, and Money, we sort of look at that. And the question is it really worth it? It's not that there's nothing there. It's just the question of, if a hazard kills one-fifth as many people as lightning does, is it really worth that prodigious amount of money? In the Chasing Ghosts book, we deal a lot with the FBI, and actually our book is probably wrong, because I have some more statistics on this, but what we argue in there from some source is that since 9/11, the United States, the FBI and other government officials have followed up 10 million leads on terrorism. And more recently, we found another source which suggests it's twice that, 20 million leads since 9/11. Each of those are real people chasing after ghosts, essentially, because obviously the vast majority of these things lead absolutely nowhere. And when you do get a terrorist, if this guy is a terrorist and you see what he did, the consequences are tragic and disgusting and stupid, essentially, from his own standpoint, but they are awfully small for the most part. And in the United States, also for that matter, most of the time in Western Europe, there hasn't been a major attack in Europe. That is, say, one that killed more than 25 people between 2005 and 2015, 10 years. That doesn't mean that the Paris attack wasn't tragic, obviously, but it was pretty much an outlier. In fact, one thing we just looked at is 9/11 itself, from which everybody, you know, the standard phrase is we can't have another 9/11. 9/11 stands out as a spectacular outlier. There's never been a terrorist attack before or after 9/11 that caused even one-tenth as much overall damage. In other words, if you go to the second, there's a set of, really terrible terrorist attacks. But if you go from number one, which is 9/11, to number two, you're going down by a full order of magnitude. The second most horrible is something like one-tenth as bad as 9/11. So 9/11, obviously, that doesn't mean 9/11 wasn't an appalling tragedy, but it does suggest that it's an extreme rarity. It has obviously proved not to be a harbinger, as people worried about in 2001, but rather as an aberration, and hopefully that'll be continued.
Well, just in closing, Dr. John Mueller, obviously the fact that the Islamic State is taking responsibility or claiming responsibility for this actions by Abdul Razak Ali Atan yesterday on your campus at The Ohio State University, it would indicate, you know, that they're really, we know that they're fairly sophisticated in social media, etc. But the whole point of terrorism is low-tech, high-impact. It's the idea of garnering attention, and they do it. So to my mind, the best way to defeat terrorism is to ignore it. If you don't give these people any attention, which is what they crave, then I think that's probably going to disarm them more than, you know, spending billions on homeland security.
Yeah, and then treating them like they're masterminds. We have a book, a chapter in the Chasing Ghosts book called The Myth of the Mastermind. There's a tendency, even in this case, when a terrorist do plan something or carry out something, is to say, well, it could have been a lot worse. As opposed to what actually happened. So he got an attack to blow up a couple of airliners, and instead of saying these guys are a bunch of bubbleheads who could never have carried that out, which is usually the case, instead you say, well, if they have been successful, then really tragic. So there's a tendency, obviously, to deal with what these guys might have possibly been able to do rather than what they're most likely capable of doing. And so there's been a tendency to sort of treat the terrorists as masterminds, which we find to be extremely unjustified. They're much more like this guy, a small guy who basically got really angry over something, or like the guy at the University of California at Merced who got really angry and then went out and did something which basically didn't make much difference, except they ended up dead themselves, very, very different as far as they're concerned. Terrorism tends not to be a low probability, high consequence event, but a low probability, low consequence event. And we should probably keep that generally in mind.
Well, Dr. John Mueller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks for the interview.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies, and a professor of both political science and dance at The Ohio State University. His books include Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, and his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the recounts of the votes in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Daniel Takagi, who is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow of election law at Moritz. He was a visiting professor in law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School, and his areas of expertise include election law, civil rights, federal courts, and he's the co-author of the casebook Election Law, Cases and Materials. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Takagi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Daniel, what do you make of all of the back and forth over this these recounts happening now in Wisconsin and perhaps will happen, or I know will happen in Pennsylvania and perhaps Michigan, although Michigan actually just finished counting on Monday. They finally got the count from the election itself, and that gave Donald Trump a very thin lead of 10,704 votes. So so that now they're going to turn around and do it again. So we know that the most extraordinary statement came out of Donald Trump in a tweet a couple of days ago, where he said that he would have won the electoral, he would have won the popular vote, which Hillary Clinton won by over 2 million and counting. He would have won it had there not been millions of fraudulent votes. He presented no evidence to that, and unfortunately, a lot of the coverage on it never had that caveat. They just literally parroted what Trump had said. So I don't think that they're doing anybody a service there. But in general, is there any way that this and what happened in Florida, will it ever get our politicians off the dime and recognize what a screwed up patchwork of unreliable voting systems we have in this country and catch up with the rest of the democratic world?
Well, I guess there are sort of two strong views on this, and I'm somewhere in between. First of all, let me talk about what I think is not in any real dispute, that Trump's claim of millions of fraudulent votes is ridiculous and completely unfounded. He apparently was in a fit of rage after the Clinton team announced it would be participating in the recount effort and send off some angry tweets that, despite the fact that he's the president-elect, don't really deserve to be taken seriously because they are completely ungrounded in reality. The sort of more difficult question, I suppose you might say, is do these recounts make any sense? Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, has been raising money around it. Last I checked, she'd raised somewhere near $7 million in support of conducting recounts in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. All three were states in which Donald Trump won, though he was not expected to win, by a fairly narrow margin. If Hillary Clinton had won all three of those states, she would have won the election. Now, the first thing that I think should be clear, and that no one is really seriously contending to the contrary, these recounts are not going to change the result of the election. It is infinitesimally unlikely that they will change the result in any of these three states, and it is inconceivable, I would say, that they will change the result in all three of those states. So Donald Trump won the election, and I expect will still have won the election after the recounts are conducted. That said, is there some value in having these recounts conducted? And there are a variety of views on this question. Some people, including many Democrats in Congress, think it's a complete waste of time and money. I tend to think there actually is some value in conducting the recounts. If it'll make people feel better that the results are on the up and up after we've done the recount, especially if it turns out that, as I expect, there's not a big difference between the announced vote and the recounted vote, if that'll make people feel better, more confident about the result that was announced, that's good, and it'll also provide us with more information. It may be that the overall count is the same, but there are some substantial discrepancies in a few places, and so those sorts of discrepancies ought to be investigated more thoroughly. So I don't think there's any chance the recount will change the result, but it might yield us some useful information.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Takagi, who's a professor of law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow of election law at Moritz. He was a visiting professor and fellow at the Harvard Law School, and his areas of expertise include election law, civil rights, and federal courts. And he's the co-author of the casebook, Election Law, Cases and Materials. So Nate Silver at 538 is saying, writing about these recounts. He says, let's not call it a recount because that's not really what it is. It's not as though merely counting the ballots a second or a third time is likely to change the results enough to overturn the outcome in three states. So what we're talking about is more like an audit or an investigation. Yeah. So would you agree with that?
I think that is probably the healthiest way to look at it, that it's not a recount in the sense that we usually think of the recount. Think back to Florida in 2000, where there was a realistic possibility that the recount would actually change the result, and there have been lots of down-ballot elections where, in fact, the recounts have changed the results. This is not that. This is not going to change the result, but I agree with the view that Nate Silver expressed in his 538 column yesterday afternoon, where he said, you know, this is really best thought of as more like an audit, even if it's technically a recount. And as I was suggesting earlier, it may detect some problems, or it may show that the announced result was correct, in which case, hopefully, it'll give us greater confidence that the election was indeed, if not a perfect election, at least one whose result can be trusted.
Well, but when Nate Silver talked about it, calling in an audit or an investigation, he went on to say an investigation that could look for signs of deliberate and widespread fraud, such as voting machines having been hacked, whole batches of ballots intentionally having been discarded, illegal coordination between election officials and campaigns, and so on. He's bringing up stuff that is very much a part of our unfortunate record. I mean, Florida 2000 certainly was a wake-up call for a lot of people. But then you go back to the close election of Kennedy and Nixon, where there a lot of dead people allegedly voted, et cetera. I mean, this...
Well, that was more than 50 years ago.
I understand, so, but
I mean, it was a different world back then when there really was widespread bread. Sped voter fraud, and you could go back further to, you know, Lyndon Johnson, who back in 1948, he basically controlled the counties. In some places, they didn't even bother to vote. But our election system today is very different now than it was more than a half century ago.
But isn't it still, if all of our intelligence, the alphabet soup of intelligence agencies in Washington all got together and said that they believe that the Russians and Russian intelligence has been interfering in our elections, isn't that reason enough to have, you know, basically eliminate that possibility that a foreign hostile power could have manipulated our elections? So,
let me be very clear. And I do think that we're now entering the territory that is rather unhealthy and floating around these kinds of conspiracy theories. There is no evidence, zero zip, that the Russian government or any other foreign power has interfered with the results of this election. And that is a point that's important to make clear. And again, if this recount can set people's minds at ease that this didn't happen, great. But there is no evidence of that. There is evidence, at least some evidence that the Washington Post in particular has uncovered, of the Russian government putting information out there that was designed to influence the result of the election, which is, of course, a very, very different thing.
And that's the fake news story that...
Yeah.
Well... But I agree, Daniel, that there's been a kind of cottage industry of professional Cassandra saying the sky is falling and all this black box stuff. And you hear it endlessly, particularly here on the Pacifica Network, about voting fraud. Yeah. And basically, there's been an awful lot of smoke, but not much fire in all
That's
of these
exactly
reports.
Right.
And I don't think these people are doing anybody a service by beating this dead horse. But that's not to say that we don't have a very screwed up and difficult voting system. We're the only country that has this whole registration business that they do, that it's different in every state. There are deadlines.
Yeah.
Impediments. There's just no question. There seems to be a different kind of mindset in terms of elections here that it's not so much about getting everybody to vote, like in Australia, you get fined if you don't vote. It's more like finding ways to frustrate people.
Well, I absolutely agree with the point that there is more the United States could do to make it easier to vote and, in fact, to encourage people to vote. And you mentioned voter registration, right? It is more difficult to register to vote here. In some other countries, in many other countries, in fact, the onus is not on the individual but on the government itself to register people to vote. And so I think if you actually look at the social science research on election reforms and which ones help people vote, what that research tends to show is that voter registration, and particularly election day registration, has a bigger impact in terms of increasing turnout than virtually any other aspect of the election system. Now, you know, we could, I suppose, move to a compulsory voting system as well, but at least at the present moment, that's most likely a non-starter in the United States, given our strong libertarian tradition as opposed to some other countries. And so I do agree with the point that if the goal is to get more people voting, voter registration is most likely the best place to start in terms of election administration reforms.
And what about this antique and peculiar Electoral College that is now, they call it a misfire, and we've had two misfires now in 15 years. And we are certainly unique in of all the democracies that where it's always first past the post. The person with, even if it's only one vote, the person with the most votes wins. And now suddenly we have a situation where Hillary Clinton may end up having 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. That's kind of peculiar, isn't it?
Well, it is one of the peculiarities of the American system. And of course, those were the rules that that were in place at the time that we held this election, and Donald Trump won by those rules, fair and square, much as though many of us would like to deny that reality. That is the reality, right? But do I think it's a fair system? No, I don't. I think it would make much more sense to move to a popular vote. One of the problems is that the Electoral College is a part of our Constitution, and constitutional amendments are extremely difficult to adopt. Now, there's been some talk of the so-called National Popular Vote Plan, which I view as effectively an end run around the difficult process of amending the Constitution, whereby states would enter into an interstate compact, effectively agreeing if states with a majority of electoral votes sign on to this compact, that their electoral votes would go to the winner of the national popular vote. But there are some real questions about whether that would be constitutional, whether it would be judged constitutional by the Supreme Court in the event that it became law. I'm not at all sure it would. So as much as I dislike the Electoral College, I don't know that the prospects for getting rid of it are very strong.
Well, but it has the effect of essentially, but first of all, you have this uncertainty. We've had 2000, and now you have, and then some people think that in your state of Ohio in 2004, where John Kerry lost very narrowly, and there was a
not that narrowly.
Well,
but, not as narrowly as these states that Clinton lost this time around.
Certainly not. But there was certainly some contention there, and the point I wanted to make was that I don't think John Kerry could have, had he won Ohio and been, 2 million short, I think, Bush was 2 million ahead in the popular vote, how he could have governed the country. And you want certainty after elections. You don't want instability.
I got to say, I'm not sure that it matters that much whether or not at the end of the day you get a majority of the popular vote. The point is that you win that election, and there's a lot of talk about whether there's a mandate or not. I think it would be foolish to claim that there was a mandate after this election, but even in the best of circumstances where someone has won convincingly, as President Obama won convincingly in both 2008 and 2012, you can claim a mandate, but it doesn't mean that the process of governance will be any easier in the era of intense partisan polarization, where the party out of power sees it as being in its best interest electorally to block everything the president wants to do. We've got some really big systemic problems in our democracy, which go well beyond who comes out to vote and who doesn't come out to vote. And it's those problems to which I think we would be best served paying attention.
But in terms of this narrow vote, as we pointed out, in the three states that are being now contested with this recount in Wisconsin and one to happen in Pennsylvania, and I assume also then again in Michigan, where I think Donald Trump won collectively by 107,000 votes. So, you know, a change of 60,000 would have gotten Hillary Clinton the presidency. So it is definitely close, and she's up to 3 million ahead in the popular vote. But I think what we'll clearly have here in terms of a mandate, mandate or no mandate, Donald Trump is going to radically change America. And that's what people
that's right. To my mind, that's exactly why the discussion of whether or not there's a mandate is a kind of a silly discussion. He has the opportunity, because he is now our president-elect, to radically change the country, and it's the next battle, not the last one, that we should be fighting.
And I thank you for joining us, Daniel Takashi.
All right. Thank you so much for having me, and take care.
Thank you. You too. And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Takagi, who's a professor of law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow at the election law at Moritz. He was a visiting professor and fellow at Harvard Law School, and his areas of expertise include election law, civil rights, the federal courts, and he's the co-author of the casebook, Election Law, Cases and Materials. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Federico Garcia. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Sing something to me.